So to begin, here's a little teaching on the Bodhisattva precepts by Suzuki Roshi at the San Francisco Zen Center in 1969. And he's talking about those Baijiang's standards. The kind of original Zen kind of like precepts to way of life that the Zen ancestor Baijiang came up with in China. And Suzuki Roshi says, when Hyakujo Zenji, that's Baijiang, established monastic life in China, many people came and wanted to practice with him, so he set up the Hyakujo Shingi, or Baijiang's pure standards. Because Hyakujo established these standards, they're called the Hyakujo Shingi. Shingi are these pure standards. Since then, in China, Zen Buddhists have practiced Zazen mostly according to the Hyakujo Shingi. In India, the Buddhists had precepts, but in China, before Hyakujo, Zen Buddhists did not have special precepts for themselves. Precepts have two sides. One is the negative prohibitory side, and the other is generating our spirit, doing something good or positive. So there's doing all good and avoiding all evil is the negative and the positive side. I think we will naturally need some way of life as a group. It may be difficult to set up all at once, but if we try hard, we will find our precepts, which include both sides. This is a very important point in practice, for our practice to help others and to help others to help themselves. Having our own way of life will encourage people to have a more spiritual and more adequate way of life for themselves. We must study our way not only for ourselves, but for all people. It is something which we must create or establish, starting from our own human situation as it is, because our precepts are actually for ourselves as human beings. As a Chinese, Hyakujo or Baijiang established these standards, and as Americans, I feel we must establish an American Shingi. I'm not saying this jokingly. I'm pretty serious. But I don't want to be too serious. If you become too serious, you'll lose your way. On the other hand, if we're playing games with it, we will lose our way. So little by little, with patience and endurance, we must find our way for ourselves. And he says, if you want to sit well, you must organize your life. So Hyakujo tries to help people to organize their lives so that they can sit well. Let's practice hard, concentrate our life on Zazen practice, and organize our life so we can sit well. So that's Suzuki Roshi thinking about Bodhisattva precepts and standards of conduct for American Zen practitioners in the old days of American Zen, 69. And I think that's kind of happened to a large extent. At Tassajara, there actually is the Tassajara Shingi that are like the pure standards, both for the summer and the winter, that evolved gradually, responding to the needs of the community. And they're probably not finished. It's always a work in progress. Yes.
How are those read or transmitted? I'm trying to remember.
I think they actually, it's several pages, and at the beginning of the practice period, they actually, someone will read them in a class. Is that how it's still?
There was a mandatory meeting, and everybody was there, and the Tanto read it slowly, and any questions anybody had were considered in the most minute detail. Took about 2.5 hours.
Oh, whoa. So
people had a lot of questions. Yeah. Does this mean really?
That's great. They had questions because then
we want to try to figure out what actually really means what it says.
People are interested enough to like. Well, we want let's agree. We want to follow this, and let's then clarify what it means. Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. Oh, could be. Could be since, yeah. I remember when I was Tanta there, you know, revising and editing them, and I think it is, you know, slowly changing. It's a lot of it's just, you know, forms of practice as well as guidelines of conduct, both, really. Right? So, since I brought this the last minute, maybe I just might as well bring this up. Kathy asked about this. I quoted Baijiang's standards attributed to Baijiang, this Hyakujo Shingi that Suzuki Roshi's talking about. And this is Dogen quoting this kind of like centerpiece of Baijiang's pure standards. This is Dogen's extensive record, section 390. Really, it's on breathing in Zazen, but it's a little side point he brings up. Page 348. Dogen's is quoting the Baijiang standards. He said, someone asked Baijiang, the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra, that's what we're studying in this class, that's Asanga's treatise on the three pure precepts is in the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra. And the Jewel Necklace Sutra contain the Mahayana precepts. And as I mentioned, this is maybe the one place in all of the huge volumes of Zen writings that this Yogacara Bhumi is brought up as the source of these three pure precepts, kind of obliquely. So they don't even list them, they say the Mahayana precepts. Taigen has a footnote that says, though, talks about this shastra that we're studying and how it's the source of these three pure precepts. So someone has Baijiang, this text of Asanga and this other sutra have these Mahayana Bodhisattva precepts. Why don't you practice according to them? Why don't we all practice with these? And Baijiang said, what I take as essential is not limited to the greater or lesser vehicles and does not differ from the greater or lesser vehicles. I condense and combine the extensive scope of regulations to establish standards for appropriate conduct. So that was, it's like the introduction to Baijiang standards. He says, let's not just practice the small vehicle, Pratimoksha precepts that were the old Indian precepts for the monks, 250 kind of self-liberation precepts. And let's not just go with the Mahayana Bodhisattva precepts either. Let's not be limited to either or differ from either. That's
typical.
That's his typical thing, right? Yeah. And then, so then Dogen says in his typical way, Baijiang said it this way, but Ehei is certainly not like this. It's not the case that it's not limited to the great or small vehicles, or not different from the great or small vehicles.
It's not that it's not different.
He's just saying, like, so Baijiang's saying, let's not be limited to the Hinayana precepts or Mahayana precepts, and let's not differ from them. And Dogen has to take that a step further, right? And make it a double negative and say that it's not the case that it's not limited to these and not different from these. It's like, it's just to say, I think it's his way of saying, I want to go beyond what Baijiang even said. What is the small vehicle? The affairs of the donkey are not complete. What is the great vehicle? The affairs of the horse have already arrived. Difficult Dogen. Zen thing. But there is this Zen phrase of talking about the Zen style and the Mahayana of that goes, the horse arrives before the donkey leaves. And we could take this to mean like the donkey, sort of like the sort of the hobbling, a little bit like not as magnificent as the horse, right? Mm-hmm. Donkey's sort of this, you know, a little bit funky, and as a grand horse. And so we could say the donkey is sort of like our sentient being, deluded self, and the horse is like the magnificent Buddha, right, in this metaphor. So then we might say, well, the donkey has to leave for the horse to arrive, but the Zen saying is, the horse arrives before the donkey leaves. Mm-hmm. Get the gist? Mm-hmm. So Buddha is here without having to get rid of our sentient being, our karmic, habitual, messed up self. The Buddha's already here. The horse has arrived before the donkey leaves. It's a nice saying. So it could be that Dogen is saying here that what is the small vehicle? The affairs of the donkey are not complete. Kind of like the small vehicle approach is to improve the donkey. the donkey's affairs still need a lot of work, right? That's the kind of small vehicle approach. What is the great vehicle? The affairs of the horse have already arrived. So I think this is a nice way of talking about the Mahayana teachings based on Buddha nature, this inherent perfection that we all are, is already complete. And we start with that. And then we can start working on the donkey, the affairs of the donkey, but we start with the horse has already arrived. So I bring this up partly because it mentions Asanga's treatise on the precepts, and partly because this discussion about small vehicle and great vehicle is going to really play out in the upcoming sections of our study here. Just to finish Dogen's little commentary on Bhajan here, he says, not the extensive scope, referring to Bhajan saying, Bhajan says, I condense and combine the extensive scope of all these precepts to establish standards. So Dogen says, not the extensive scope means the extremely great is the same as the small. Not condensed means the extremely small is the same as the great. I do not combine, but gallop over and drop away great and small. Already having accomplished this, how shall we go beyond? After a pause, Dogen answers himself. When healthy and energetic, we do zazen without falling asleep. When hungry, we eat rice and know we are fully satisfied. It's this beautiful Dogen getting into this very, you know, lofty, cosmic kind of talk. And then he says, how is it? Just doing zazen without falling asleep, eating when we're hungry, and knowing we're full. And we might say, that's Dogen's precepts. That's Dogen's combining all the small and great vehicle precepts into just sit zazen and don't fall asleep. And, you know, eat your rice when you're hungry. The small vehicle precepts say, if you're hungry but it's afternoon, better not eat your rice. Wait till the next morning. Dogen says, if you're hungry, eat it.
But also, and know...
And know that you're full and satisfied.
And that's big.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so... To know when...
Aware. And
you're satisfied.
Yep.
This is enough.
Yep. And you could take this on layers and layers of meaning, you know, eating your rice and knowing you're satisfied, like be Buddha and, you know, practice your daily activities and be satisfied with this. You could hear it like that too. Also about, this is the Chanyuan Chingwe, or the Zenen Shingi, which Dogen quotes all the time when he's talking about his kind of setup for practicing in the Zen temple. So it's kind of maybe inspired by Baijiang's Shingi. Then later, lots of other Shingis were written in China, but this is the one that really like kind of took hold. And that, in fact, a lot of our forms currently come from this. Like, this describes the Oryoki ritual, the Oryoki eating ritual, like exactly like we do it. And Dogen describes it too, but Dogen just pulls it right out of this book, which was like about, I think, maybe 100 years before Dogen's time in China. This is called The Origins of Buddhist Monastic Codes in China. And it's a lot of history, but it's also a translation of this text, which is not so much about like precepts of like how you should avoid harm and do good, or maybe a little bit of that, but it's mostly about like how you do a tea ceremony in the Zendo and like how you do all these ceremonies. It's a lot, and it's a lot about all the positions, how all the different different roles in the temple are set up. So it's kind of a nice model that still we, even like Tassajara practice is, because Dogen based his teachings on this, it's still followed.
So we think we're following Dogen, but we're really...
A lot of the time, it's this. Not only, like, you know, Dogen has a long essay on Oryoki that is almost like the whole essay is almost a direct quote from this book, but I maybe also be nice to mention that the Fukan Zazengi, which is, you know, Dogen's most famous Zazen instruction manual, right, is almost, you know, maybe half of it is taken like verbatim from this. Because this also has a Zazengi, there's a Zazengi, Zazen instructions as part of this Shingi, pure standards. And Dogen's original Fukan Zazengi was almost exactly out of here. With his little, he added in little flourishes. And then he revised it and changed a little bit more. Like, think of not thinking is not in this one. But a lot of the posture instructions and so on are just straight out of here.
Okay, can you remind us what is the actual text in there?
It's called the Chanyuan Chingwe, or sometimes when you in the Shobo Genzo, it's the Japanese way of saying it, it's the Zenen Shingi, which means the pure standards for the Zen garden. The Zen,
what is it again?
The Zen garden. Chanyuan.
Chingwe.
Chingwe is the Chinese way of saying Shingi.
Because in the instructions to the Tenzin.
Oh, yeah, he quotes this. Yep.
There's this thing he keeps
that's
referring
it.
To.
This is
I
it.
I just realized yep. that is that.
So yep.
There's also things there.
Yeah.
About Tenzin.
So you might enjoy reading this at some point. It has a section on the Tenzo.
Yeah.
The original Tenzo instructions. Yeah.
Okay.
I can borrow it after.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, that's exactly, yeah, and the Tenzo Kyokun, he quotes all through the Shobo Genzo. He really likes this book. But in the preface by the Zen teacher Zongze, he's saying, although in principle two different sets of Vinaya should not exist, Vinaya is like the, you know, the Indian monastic precepts. In principle, there shouldn't be two sets of Vinaya, but there is this particular tradition in the Zen school, where it's literally like there's this wind of the house of the patched robe disciples, is what it literally says. The patched robe monks are the Zen practitioners. So there's this particular tradition in our school that stands apart from the general common regulations. This tradition holds that for those individuals who enjoy the fruits of Dharma on the way to awakening, who are extraordinarily pure and exalted, the general precepts need not apply. A little preface is kind of a dangerous statement, right? But for those monks who've not attained such lofty qualities, neglecting the Vinaya is much like coming up against a wall. And it can be said that this neglect will result in a loss of respect in the eyes of others. Therefore, I've compiled this whole book of Zen precepts and standards. But I just thought that was interesting that there's, because I also think this relates to a little bit what's going on in Asanga when he's making this Mahayana distinction. Here they're saying, you know, we have all these small vehicle Vinaya precepts in the Chinese Zen school, and it's good to keep them, but we also have this style in our patch road school of, you know, you need not follow all the small vehicle precepts necessarily if your understanding is very clear. That's kind of what he's pointing out. And I think that's what Asanga is pointing out too, is that if we're not following all the precepts in the more usual conventional way, then we have to be very careful to like where we come in, about our intention, where we're coming from. I think that's what he's driving at. So, without further ado, back to Asanga on page 5. Near the top of page 5, this is Asanga's talking about actually the ceremony for receiving the Bodhisattva precepts, for the three pure precepts. And we went over some of it last time, so just kind of in the middle of that first paragraph, setting up before himself an image of the Tathagata, he does prostrations, and in a humble manner, kneeling on his right knee or on both knees, he should address the learned Bodhisattva, which is the preceptor here. Child of good family. So both are called, both the one receiving and the one giving the precepts are both called children of good family, which means, as I mentioned last time, the commentaries say good family means the Mahayana. Mm-hmm. It means the Bodhisattva vehicle is the family that when we receive the Bodhisattva precepts, we join the Bodhisattva family. And I just think it's interesting that, you know, our Jukai ceremony, all our precept ceremonies are very similar to this 3rd century Indian ceremony. We do prostrations before the Buddha. We kneel in chokhi on both knees, right? And we ask for the precepts. Please grant me the Bodhisattva precepts, discipline and commitment. Adopting one-pointed mindfulness, he gives rise to a serene thought. Now my attainment of the great treasury of merit, unsurpassed, inexhaustible, and measureless, is not far off. In other words, the student about to receive them is like, this is so amazing, I'm about to receive the precepts. This is the greatest thing ever. I think this is what this language is saying. The preceptor, learned Bodhisattva, who may be standing or seating, shall say with an unwavering thought to the aspirant Bodhisattva, child of good family, or Dharma brother or sister so-and-so, are you a Bodhisattva? Have you made the resolve for awakening? Which means, have you generated bodhicitta? Do you have this wish to be a Buddha and help all beings become Buddhas, be awake and free from all suffering? And this, the aspirant must affirm, saying, it is so, or yes, I will.
That's what happens
yes,
in our
yes, I will. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of that call and response thing is just goes way back, right? Mm-hmm. And affirming and everything to being done three times is also in the ceremony, just to really make it sink in.
And we know this is valid. This,
yeah, this is
from
really.
That time, right?
Yeah, we have this is Sanskrit text of a sangha. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the comment both Chinese and Tibetan commentaries go way way back. So it could be slightly altered from its original, but yeah. And there, because there's also translations in these different languages, like Chinese and Tibetan, we know that there was this original Indian mm-hmm. text. Asanga lived about in like the 4th century Common Era.
Is this 310 to 390?
Yeah, yeah. So thereupon the preceptor says, will you, child of good family so-and-so, receive from me all the bodhisattva bases of training and the bodhisattva precepts? In other words, the precept of standards of conduct, the precept of embracing good qualities, and the precept of benefiting sentient beings. Whatever the bases of training and the precepts of all bodhisattvas of past, future, and present in the 10 directions may be, which is these three pure precepts, which are extensively elaborated on in this treatise. And he says, yes, I will. Mm-hmm. And the preceptor says this a second and a third time, and when asked, the recipient bodhisattva should all three times affirm it. And I left out, as I edited this text, long sections. And so there's some stuff after, that's the ceremony. That's the heart of the ceremony. It's just, will you keep these precepts? He asks three times. Yes, I will, three times, is the fulfillment of receiving. And I also heard an interesting comment on this, because the Tibetans follow all these same type of practices and for refuge ceremonies and precept ceremonies, this three times call and response. And they make it clear that it's actually in some of these texts. On the third repetition, they want to say, what's the exact precise moment that you receive the precepts or that you've finished taking refuge? It's at the third time you say, yes, I will, or the third time you repeat the refuges. At that last moment, it's like, it's happened. It's almost like, and sometimes they even say there's like a precept substance that like is that you receive for the rest of eternity. not a visible substance, but like a even the Abhidharma talks about there's this unmanifest form that happens when you make a formal vow. It's quite interesting with some of the discussions about this that we maybe won't get into this time, but so I watched this one bodhisattva vow ceremony, and on the third time, the teacher, he'd explained this beforehand. He's like, at the third time, when you say yes, I will, I'm going to snap my fingers, and at that time, then you'll know you've received them. And so he's right at that time, yes, I will. I thought that was kind of an interesting and unusual thing to mark that moment. Yeah, like it's happened. This was a particular Tibetan teacher that like said, "I'm going to snap my fingers, and that then you'll know you've received the precepts, or you've taken you've finished taking refuge, so you can like mark this moment." And I think we have particular moments in our ceremonies that have significance.
The practice period.
Clunk.
The moment is always a really dramatic thing. It is over.
There's an instrument where you slam a wooden block on a wooden block, the finality. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the moment it's open, this is the moment it's closed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's nice to celebrate moments in our practice. So this is one of those.
Is there such a moment like this
in regards to Dharma transmissions, we have student and teacher.
I think there's particular moments. There's one, you know, it's like a 7-day ceremony of Dharma transmission, and there's one part on the first day at the beginning that's like there's it's all these sub ceremonies within this 7-day ceremony, and this is one very simple ceremony that's just a face to face meeting where some words are spoken, and sometimes they said that's the Dharma transmission. It actually happens on the first day, and then there's this all these things of like copying documents and stuff that happen afterwards, and the more in a way more dramatic ceremonial enactments come later. But they said that first very simple thing was the actual moment. So yeah, I think we do have things like moments, and the you know, touching the water, wisdom water to the top of the head is like an initiation moment. And if you, I think if you're I think the nice thing about when you said, I'm telling you in advance, there's going to be this moment, and then you can prime yourself for a moment, right? You can say, okay, for this moment, I'm going to be like, just completely let go of everything for one moment, because we can maybe do that for one moment.
Another ceremony we have that really has a lot of that is the Shuso ceremony with the staff, and that feeling when you're sitting there and you turn and you say, you know, dragons and elephants, mm-hmm. you know, bring me your questions, and then you
yep.
pin it.
Yep, that starts it.
You know, the circle, the wheel starts turning.
Yeah,
you know,
that's the moment of beginning.
And the slowness of getting it, and then, you know, mm-hmm. and everybody witnessing, here mm-hmm. it goes, here it goes, here it goes, and now, boom.
Yeah.
Let the Dharma reveal itself. You know?
Yeah. And then at the end of this ceremony, the text actually says, and then all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas throughout the universe see signs. There's in our ceremony, Dogen says this too, right? There's an auspicious omen. The earth quakes in many ways. I think Asanga doesn't say that the earth quakes, but in both texts, they say there's a sign at the moment of receiving the precepts. A sign manifests throughout the whole universe, and all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are like, "Wow, some people have just joined our family over there on planet Earth." And the Sangha is very similar in this one too. That there's this like, and then there's a celebration. It's a very celebratory feeling, like. All the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are dancing around and rejoicing. This is so great that somebody wants to live like a Bodhisattva to benefit all beings. So it's this great, joyful celebration. And what is the purpose of making a formal vow or a ceremony? Oh, we heard about, like, on the very first paragraph, on the first page, there was this thing about when you receive the Bodhisattva precepts from someone else, you have this, and then you go, against them, you feel some kind of, like, embarrassed. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a good thing, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, if you just make the vow yourself, mm-hmm. informally, you don't feel that as much, so that's one advantage of formally receiving from a human person mm-hmm. that you respect, mm-hmm. and another reason is that the mind easily changes. So if you make a vow, it's like a commitment. Then when your mind changes, you push against it. Like but I made this vow. It becomes a problem for you. A good problem. And it's also said, clothing and the name. I read some commentary that they said the name reminds you, your Dharma name reminds you of receiving the precepts and your aspiration. And all of that is all support. And the more kind of like gifts and stuff you get as part of it, the more encouraged you may feel to I really feel encouraged to uphold this. And another thing that's sometimes said is that if you have, it's like there's more merit generated if you keep the precepts when you have the vow or commitment to keep them, than when you, even if you're living the same way but you don't have the vow, there's less merit involved. So you could say, what's that about? And I think it's an interesting principle. And the way I understand it is, it's like, because you might, if you don't have the vow, you might just naturally be a good person and just like not be harming others, but it's just your nature anyway. But if you have the vow and then you're kind of usually doing that and you come up against it sometimes and you're struggling, or even if it's not a struggle and you're just naturally following, something about the fact that you have this commitment to it also, even if it's an easy commitment, makes it more beneficial. It's something to contemplate. Like Dogen even says quite radically at one point, something like it's better to receive the precepts and break them than to not receive them but follow them. Whoa, that one's really, makes you stop, right? And like, and again, to think like, Dogen, I don't think he's just magical thinking that he's just trying to encourage people, just do this. I think it's about that you have the vow or a commitment is like an ongoing intention. It's like, I set this intention, I'm going to try to follow it, and I keep falling short, I keep messing up, but I keep going because I have this commitment, rather than, I don't have any particular commitment, but today I just didn't harm anyone. Something like that, you can consider it.
It feels like it might be because if you do, after taking the vows, as we and Anna would do break the precepts, it's always with you, you feel it. And so some part of your consciousness is with that.
So
the whole vow is, the whole precept is more alive because
it's that ongoing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes it harder. But it's like we don't ever try to do any, make commitments just to be hard. Because that's like, I really feel like this is the direction I want to go, and I have all this ancient twisted karma that keeps pulling me off track. And the precepts, even in one of the commentaries, it said to make these vows doesn't mean that you have to keep them. It means you will fail. And if you think like, I have to keep them perfectly, you'll go crazy because you can't. But it just means this is the direction I want to go. I want to keep them as well as I can, and I can fall down and get up and keep going. So it's this direction. So now we have this is quite an interesting thing here too, that this ceremony is kind of based on these earlier Indian ceremonies of receiving like monastic precepts or individual liberation precepts that have from the time of the Buddha, the monastics for a fully ordained bhikshu, they have 250 precepts, right, in one tradition, and they're all different categories of major and minor with different penalties. And the four parajikas, they're called, are the four, parajika means like, often translated as defeat, means like if you break, you've defeated your monastic vow, and you're no longer a bhikshu, and you can no longer, and you can't take the precepts again, or you can't, and you can't repent for them. Just with these four. All the other ones, there's things you can do to restore them, but these four are like, if you don't relinquish the vow beforehand, you can always, at the last minute, say, immediately just tell another human being, I relinquish my bhikshu's vows, and then if you break them, then you could retake them again later, strictly speaking. But if you hold the vow and you break it, it's like, it's a defeat, meaning like, and this happens, right, in the world, even in modern times, that then you return to lay life, and you can never, even after 100 years, you could never reordain. So the Buddha was like really serious. And those four, those four are, interestingly,
I'm already shuddering.
It's a little, I shudder myself.
I'm shuddering.
Well, interesting, the first one is celibacy, actually. So not just misusing. So we don't take those bhikshuni vows, if you have that vow and you don't decide to change it first, then I think isn't not just misusing sexuality, but like just sexual conduct. So the Buddha seemed like. And maybe he put this first of the whole 250 because he thought, actually, it's not that hard to break it. and if I don't treat this really seriously, it's going to change our whole order. And, you know, we could have a whole discussion about why he's emphasizing this, but maybe we could see it partly as this thing, like, if in the ancient days of India, where there's no birth control, then you'd be having all these monks and nuns would be having kids, right? That could be happening, and then the Sangha would have to take care of them, and you'd have a whole new situation, living out in the forest together. You'd have like Green Gulch, and even at Green Gulch, it's complicated because like, and people complain. Because like, you mean this person is gonna get like child support and like this extra stipend to raise their children and even put their kids through college when I'm only getting paid this much? That's one issue that comes up at San Francisco Zen Center with the kids. But without getting into all those reasons, in the early days, breaking celibacy, killing a human being, those are like on the same level. It's kind of radical, right? Stealing something that's like that would be punishable by law. So not just like, you know, taking a book from your friend or something. Something, there's lesser precepts about stealing little things, and lying, but the particular lying about one's spiritual attainments. Yeah, which is...
Like bragging?
Yeah, and I think particularly it's put in a kind of a livelihood thing, that the monks depended on alms, and maybe some of the monks who had more spiritual attainments would be better supported. So they'd say, you know, I know you're supporting them, but like, I'm an arhat, actually. And like, you might want to support me, because there's more merit in supporting an arhat. So the Buddha's like, this is like major, major... If it's true, then there's minor precepts even about if it's true, you're not really supposed to talk about it. But if it's not true, it's a major parajika. So interesting. That would also be maybe not so hard to break. Maybe the easiest of the four. You just casually say something. So anyway, these are these four parajika. So, Asanga's, I think, playing with this is saying, here's the ceremony at which, in the old days, here's the ceremony, and then you have to follow these four parajika precepts. And here he's saying, these are the bodhisattva parajika, the defeats, the kind of like the major defeats. This is the next section. Accordingly, there are four events that function in likeness to individual liberation, pratimoksha, grounds for defeat, parajika, for a bodhisattva established in the vow. What are these four? And we're going to see later how I wouldn't have made this connection, but a commentary correlates them with those other old four parajika. But in this case, these four, you might recognize them. I'll tell you beforehand. So you can see as we go through. But they're basically, we have our 10 bodhisattva precepts that come from the Brahmajala Sutra. These are basically the last four of our 10. I think it's how all these things are woven together when you look at them is so interesting to me. Like our first five are kind of standard, almost the same as lay precepts at the time of Buddha. And the last four are straight out of here. And so the number six is not speaking of others' faults. Isn't on either one of those particular lists, but it's one of the standard right speech practices. So anyway, these last four. So, but a little commentary, a little elaboration. With a longing for gain and respect, to praise oneself and belittle others is the first event that is grounds of defeat for a bodhisattva. So our seventh precept is to praise self and belittle others, or praise self at the expense of others. But here, it's a nice little addition that I think we could think about with our precepts, is with a longing for gain and respect. It's kind of like, I'm praising myself particularly so that others will, to gain more respect from others. I'm the best and they're not so good. It's a little like, well, maybe we can correlate these. As you can see, that's quite similar to that lying about spiritual attainments to gain respect and support as the small vehicle parajika. It's sort of correlated with that. And the next one is cold-heartedly failing to donate material things out of attachment, or not teaching dharma out of stinginess to those who are suffering and needy with no protector, or eager for dharma and who have approached in a proper manner. To be possessive of material things or dharma is the second parajika.
And what is the simple statement of that in our
precepts? So we often we say not possessive of anything, but literally in Dogen's, and often I've been saying in our full moon ceremonies, literally it reads, not possessive of dharma or wealth or dharma and material things. So even in Dogen's version, he breaks it into these two things, which are also two kinds of giving. You can give materially and you can give dharma. So likewise, you're not possessive of dharma. Which, you know, what does that mean? Well, it could mean, like, if somebody asks you for some teaching or something, if you're in a situation where that would happen, you don't say, no, I don't think you should hear about that, or whatever. It's like you want to share dharma, and you want to share materially. But this, you know, qualifies it a little bit. It's sort of cold-heartedly failing out of attachment, or stinginess to those who are suffering and needy with no protector and who have approached in the proper manner. I really like that part because that means, like, I'm thinking, say, like homeless people, if they like come up in an improper manner, say, hey, and they just grab you, like, give me that, you know, that's like, then it's not, you wouldn't be breaking that precept necessarily to not give to them because it wasn't respectfully approaching you in the proper manner. And I think of another one that, I don't know, it's maybe a little bit on the edge, but I've been getting more calls recently from the telemarketers, you know, that like ask you for donations for various things. And I feel like in the mail, it's like they come in the mail too, right? And it's okay, you can open them, look at them, you can recycle them. But somehow I feel like it's a little invasive actually to call you in your home and just start going to the spiel, like, hey, you should know about the da-da-da. I'm like, it feels a little bit like invading privacy. And I guess our culture doesn't really see it that way.
Well, there's a no-call list you can get
on. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because people do see
that it's an invasion. Yeah. So I've been saying recently something like, when they sometimes launch into, I can tell they're reading this long thing, and there's not a conversation. And this has happened last week, and I interrupt, it's a monologue, yeah. And I interrupted them, excuse me, and they da da da, and they kind of stopped. Marking their place. Yes?
Oh, no, I'm alive.
And I said something like, this is a monologue. I'm trying to relate, you know, and say, like, I just feel like we're not having an intimate conversation. I actually said this.
I'm like,
if you want to just, you know, have actual conversation, then we could do that. And I actually really, and I usually try to tell them, I really respect the work that you're doing, because almost all of them are doing something good. And I thank you very much for it. And I'll consider making a donation in the mail or online. I'm not up for this kind of monologue conversation right now. Thank you. And they usually they go, okay, bye. And then sometimes I think, oh, is this... A couple of times, you know, these synchronicity things, I think two of these calls just in the last month, one of them was, I think, right after this class. And I think we were just talking about giving, or one of these, or a Dharma talk or something, I was talking about giving. I walked right in the door and the phone rang and says, excuse me, can you give us? And I did my little, I'm like, I'm not open to this. And then after I hung up with them, I'm like, wow, that was like so interesting. Yeah, it's like a test. Like, and I wonder, did I fail that test? And then I hear this thing about approaching in a proper manner. Maybe okay.
Well, actually, I do think that to make that distinction, because I feel really differently. Like the people who stand on the mall and have their cause, they really, you know, they're willing to engage in a conversation with you for the most part. That's been my experience. And you can be, you can actually be real people together. But I don't think it's approaching people properly to call them in their home and not even ask them if they're interested in having a conversation.
Yeah, and even on the street, sometimes like the Greenpeace people and stuff, when they come up to you, you know, there's a little bit of that feeling like, I like it when they don't. I like it when you can walk up to them if you're not in a hurry and you see who they are and you can go interact. And obviously they're not going to get as much fundraising probably if they just wait. But and maybe, you know, there is this traditional practice for the Buddha's monks on alms round is you never like approach anyone. You never ask. So it's not, strictly speaking, maybe not really begging, because you just stand or walk in a way where people might see you. But, like, it would be breaking one of those 250 minor precepts if you, like, went up to somebody and said, I'm hungry, can you give me something? Mm-hmm. It's very much like you're just making yourself known, but not even asking. I think it's beautiful that the Buddha set it up that way. Mm-hmm. So that people don't feel, like, obliged. But if they want to give, they want to give. Yeah. And I think it's true in our culture that, you know, if you're not pushed, you're not as likely to give. But
space for generosity.
Yeah. 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 True generosity.
So how do we equate that with the sharing of the Dharma? Because, in my humble opinion, there are those I come in contact with that could benefit.
Oh yeah.
From.
Interesting point.
Mm-hmm.
And
at the same time, they're not necessarily, their approach isn't necessarily appealing.
They're not asking for it, right?
Sometimes they're not asking for it. Sometimes they don't appear open.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, in my humble opinion, they deserve some.
Yeah, it's tricky. I think it's all about skillful means there and being really attentive to the particular situation and choosing language carefully. So it might be like, it might not sound like Dharma to them, but it's just something that might help them. And it's also about your relationship with them.
I've grown to try to recognize when it's okay to let somebody make a mistake.
Yeah, that's sometimes a good thing.
Absolutely, the best teacher. Mm-hmm. I found out for myself.
Yep. Yeah. Or another thing is you know, was it in this class last week where we talked about asking people, like, would you like some Dharma? would you like, I haven't been observing something. Would you like to hear? And they might say, like, no, I don't want
to
hear.
That really occurs to me.
Yeah, you can ask.
It really occurs to me to ask if you would like some advice.
Yeah. Gives people a chance. And it gives, it lets them get ready. They might not, if you didn't ask, they might be like, why is he telling me? But if you ask, then they might be like, well, I wouldn't have asked for it, but now that they're offering it, and I'm kind of ready, I'm in this mode, I can shift on my receptivity switch, and like, okay, yeah, and then they can maybe hear.
That's good.
Yeah. So, yeah, not being possessive of Dharma or resources, and that kind of goes along with this original parajika of stealing, right? Mm-hmm. It's in a way you could say the four original ones are like very extreme harm for the most part, like killing a human or something, and these bodhisattva ones are like much more refined. So not only do we not steal, but we're not possessive either, right? It's like going way beyond. And then the
anger and striking others.
Yeah, overwhelmed by anger and striking or hurting sentient beings with one's hand, a clump of earth or a stick, without forgiveness or accepting another's apology.
To indulge
in anger is the third grounds for defeat. So yeah, you know, and what I was surprised about is it doesn't mention verbal abuse, you know, angrily.
In anger,
yeah,
scenes.
Yeah,
Yeah. Stoking the fire.
Yeah, but you could say it's, yeah, strictly speaking, it sounds like it's particularly like physical hitting, which leaves a lot of room, that's I think what you're saying, for other kinds of expression of anger. But I think in our spirit of, we would say, just not acting out your anger towards others in any way. And that's... What's that?
Is it ill will?
Yeah, ill will, not harboring ill will. Mm-hmm. And again, Dogen's precept is kind of like, more literally, like not... It's kind of like not even being angry. But we might say not indulging your... Not acting on your anger. And that kind of correlates with not killing a human, right? This is way less intense than that, but the bodhisattvas, not only do they not kill people, but they don't indulge in anger towards them. And then lastly, and also that one includes refusing to accept apology, I think is a nice part there, right? It's kind of like you could be really angry, and then somebody says, okay, I'm sorry, and like, I'm not going to forgive you. Mm-hmm. That's breaking the precept. But it's like, I'm really angry, but okay, I accept your apology. Mm-hmm. Maybe I don't even forgive you completely, but I accept your apology, because that's letting the other person reform, right? And you say, I'm not going to let you reform. So bodhisattva, that's like big. And then refusing to accept the bodhisattva teachings and devoting oneself to false versions of the good teaching, and then enjoying teaching others and establishing those false teachings to disparage the true Dharma is the fourth parajika.
So we say not disparaging the three treasures.
The three treasures. So this is particularly taking the Dharma. Mm-hmm. And it's particularly in the commentaries to bring out the point that particularly disparaging the Mahayana bodhisattva Dharma. And this early days of the Mahayana in India, actually, where it was maybe a little bit like the Pratimoksha precept monks were maybe, what's this with this like Mahayana precepts thing where you're, and later you're going to see how you can even break some precepts. And so maybe people would be like, I don't know about that dharma. So the Mahayana does a lot of like, don't like fall back into just the, this other individual liberation mode. That's disparaging the bodhisattva, this new radical Mahayana dharma. And that one actually I think, going back to these four old Parajika, I think that one actually correlates with lying about having attained dharma. This would be like bodhisattvas not admitting that they have attained the Mahayana dharma. They have heard these teachings, but they're teaching non-dharma. So it's a little twist on, instead of saying, I have attained this dharma that I haven't, it's saying, actually, I have attained this dharma, but I'm going to pretend I haven't and just go back to the small vehicle dharma.
Interesting.
And so then I made a mistake when I said the first one of with longing for gain and respect to praise self and belittle others. Actually, one commentary says that sort of correlates with this sexual conduct. This, we might say misusing sexuality, particularly because it's the longing for gain, like I'm going to like take advantage of this person to get something for myself, and respect, maybe there's some, this is sort of extrapolating, but maybe like you could use sexuality to like boost your sense of self, and maybe especially like in a way that sort of like enslaves another. Might be like, in order for them to like serve me sexually, right? It's a little bit of a stretch. It's pretty unrelated to this non-celibacy precept, but somebody tried to correlate those, and I think it's praising self and belittling others. You could see it. You could maybe see how misusing sexuality could be without, not a verbal thing, but could be a kind of, uplifting oneself and belittling another, right? That would be what we might call misusing sexuality. So that's the four defeats for a bodhisattva. So it's kind of nice that we have the three pure precepts of our tradition in here, and now we have these four of our 10 major bodhisattva precepts are also in here. And then these are the four events. Should a bodhisattva commit any one of them, not to mention all of them, his opportunity to gather and understand the vast resources that he needs for awakening will disappear for the moment. For the present, there's no opportunity for a purified intention. He's not a genuine bodhisattva. On the other hand, the bodhisattva will not relinquish the precepts, discipline, and commitment with medium or lesser involvement in these four events that are grounds for defeat. Relinquishment is the result of a greater degree of involvement by which the bodhisattva makes a regular practice of these four events that are these defeats, generates not the slightest sense of self-respect and conscience, is pleased with and glad about his conduct, and believes in its good qualities. This should be understood as greater involvement. So even if you break them, but you feel like, oh, I feel not good about it, that actually isn't the major breakage. But if you like, I broke it, and I feel so good that I got angry, and next time I see them, I'm going to be just as angry. That's like, and if you kind of continue in that spirit, then that's like, now we're losing the bodhisattva spirit. So it's quite forgiving. If you just a little bit is a minor thing, you don't lose them. But if this major way, if you don't even have the slightest regret, then it's a parajika defeat. But even then, so this is, the bodhisattva does not relinquish the bodhisattva precepts, discipline, and commitment by only once committing an act that's being grounds for defeat, even a major one, as a monk does relinquish his pratimoksha vow with his events of defeat. Like I mentioned, it's still the case in like Theravada countries that if you actually, not many people kill another human, but if you lie about your spiritual attainments or you break your celibacy vow, then you lose your monastic status, and you can never retake them again. And I've heard this has happened even in with the Western monks sometimes. They have these provisions, like you can still kind of sort of like live in the community as this sort of like lay person living like a monk kind of thing or something.
Western Theravada monks?
Yeah, Western Theravada. You know, in the Mahayana, where they still have, as I mentioned in an earlier class, every country but Japan still has these four parajika, actually. So like China and Korea and Vietnam and Tibet, those traditions. But just having talked to a lot of monastics in those traditions over the years and interested in exploring how they understand all these monastic things, there's this interesting thing that in the Mahayana, even though there's these, it's right, it's very explicit in the Vinaya text that it's like, especially around the celibacy one, because this is the one that often comes up and often why people disrobe. In these Mahayana traditions, often, it depends on the strictness of it, but often there's some forgiveness around that precept. Even though, strictly speaking, there technically isn't. They're kind of in, because of this Mahayana spirit of forgiveness, there's like, well, that's, you really messed up, but like, you should just do like 100 million prostrations and repent for a long time. And like, if you really want to get back on board with this, I think that's interesting. I think that's in the spirit of Asangas. But he's going to mention this, actually. So some more stricter, even Mahayana lineages would say, that's too much. But so the Mahayana is very forgiving, that even if you break these parajika, according to Asanga, the text where he's inventing this, basically, he's like, you can retake them again. You don't lose them unless you have no sense of repentance or shame for a long time, and you're constantly breaking them in a big way. Then you kind of do start to lose the precepts. But even then, you can retake them again. And so one commentary brought up a nice image of like the Pratimoksha precepts are like a glass vase. Mm-hmm. So like a vase is kind of a nice way to talk about the precepts, right? Because it's kind of like it's a container for your that holds your life nicely and together, and holds flowers. Actually, in the Vinaya Pitaka, as Jean mentioned, the Vinaya Pitaka the other night, it's not just like a list of 250 precepts. It's like huge volumes and volumes of stories and texts and history. This is amazing teachings in addition to all these, just the precepts. And as it's the very beginning of the Vinaya Pitaka, the Buddha is talking about Ananda or somebody asks, why do you set up this Pratimoksha? And he says, it's like, he's like the seven ancient Buddhas, like the first few of them didn't have pratimoksha. They were totally enlightened Buddhas, and they just like, they didn't have any like form. They just like met people and would just look into their eyes, and people would just wake up and become Buddhas. And but after they died, their order didn't last very long. The Dharma quickly faded out because they were amazing Buddhas, but they didn't have any like structure. And he said that's like a bunch of flowers that you just like stand up on a on a something like you stand a bunch of flowers on the ground and they just all fall over. And then he said these next three of the ancient Buddhas, seven ancient Buddhas, taught the precepts and set up precepts for their to have a sangha that has precepts. And that's like when you tie the flowers together, when you kind of wrap the flowers to keep them together, and it's a beautiful bouquet. And their sangha, their dharma and sangha lasted long. So he's like, so Buddha tells that story, and then I think it's Ananda says, well, then now is the time, Buddha, set it up. We want this dharma to last long in this kalpa. And the Buddha's like, not so quick, Ananda. The Buddhas don't just set this up randomly. They set it up in response to situations that are arising. So let's wait. Let's wait for some trouble. And then we'll say, because actually the sangha is totally, everyone's just in harmony. And then trouble came. And Buddha set it up. So I just thought of that image, though, because he talks about the flowers held together, and maybe this vase is sort of refers to that intentionally or unintentionally. The pratimoksha is like a glass vase. If you drop it and it breaks, you can't repair it. And the bodhisattva Mahayana precepts are like a gold vase. You drop it and it gets dented, but then you can repair it. It's nice. It's not all is not lost. The bodhisattva still has an opportunity to receive the bodhisattva precepts, discipline, and commitment in the same lifetime. The monk in the pratimoksha vow, for whom a defeat has developed, has no such opportunity. So in that way too, they sometimes, because the bodhisattva precept never really disappears, unless I suppose you really intentionally relinquish it. I hate bodhisattvas. I want nothing to do with it anymore, and I want to harm everyone. Period. Then I guess you actually it's gone. If you continue to maintain that spirit, and then but otherwise, even if you mess up some. It's, you know, lifetime after lifetime. And they even say, you do the ceremony in the next life, and of course you don't remember the past, but you're just renewing your vow from the past. So people who are maybe drawn to receiving bodhisattva precepts maybe have some karmic connection. Maybe many, many times in the past they received this again and again, and they're just renewing it. So now... Oh. Well, we can start this first. This is a really radical section. Even in the case of what is reprehensible by nature, and this means precepts like killing are just not just like a Buddhist cultural sort of precept. Like not eating after noon is not reprehensible by nature. That's just something the Buddha designed for his community. But something like killing, like everyone in the world agrees, like this is harmful. So that's there's precepts that are reprehensible or harmful by nature. Even in that case, the bodhisattva acts with such skill and means that no fault ensues when they break these natural precepts is possible. Rather, there's a spread of much merit. So here's the examples, and he's going to go through the first seven wholesome actions of body and speech. Because he's not going to go through the mind precepts. He's going to go through killing, stealing, misusing sexuality, then these lying, speaking of others' faults, harsh speech and idle chatter. Mm-hmm. And then these are sometimes called the 10 wholesome actions, and then there's greed, hate, and delusion, or the mind ones. So the bodhisattva can never break the mind ones out of for skillful means, because that doesn't make any sense. I'm going to like think a thought of hate as a skillful means. No, that will never benefit anyone. But body and speech, There might be times when they have a mind of great compassion, they might violate, they might kill, for example.
I'm sorry, I just reminded of an example that you're about to give one.
Well, Asanga is going to give one.
Okay.
So here's one first. But I think we can see with all these, or at least with this one especially, I think we can see in modern times this kind of thing. And we can discuss whether it's appropriate or not, situations like Saddam Hussein or whatever, Hitler, right? So in this case, the Bodhisattva, accordingly, the Bodhisattva may behold a robber or thief, no.
Yeah,
is that the one?
That.
Robber or thief engaged in committing a great deed, great many deeds of immediate retribution, being about to murder many hundreds of magnificent living beings, including Shravakas, Pratyeka Buddhas, and Bodhisattvas, not to mention all kinds of others, for the sake of a few material goods. So an armed robber is going to kill all these great people. Seeing this, he forms this thought, if I take the life of this sentient being, this robber, I myself may be reborn as one of the creatures of hell. Better that I be reborn as a creature of hell than that this living being, having committed a deed of immediate retribution, should go straight to hell himself. With such an attitude, the Bodhisattva ascertains that the thought is virtuous or indeterminate, and then, with only a thought of compassion for the consequence, he kills that living being. There is no fault, but a spread of much merit.
This is before automatic weapons.
Yeah. So it's hard to imagine a kind of situation where, but it's, you know, you have to imagine that there's no alternative to, like, if you could tie the person up or imprison them, of course that's better than killing them. If there's a scenario where the only way to stop them is to actually kill them, then the Bodhisattva does this. And I think in this time in India, this was like really radical in the Buddhist community, mm-hmm. where these you know, killing was like, no matter what, you just never break it. It's like a very literal thing. And he's saying the Bodhisattva is all about intention. Mm-hmm. So if it will benefit, and interestingly, he's like, I might go to hell myself, even though, that's an interesting point, even though I'm coming from compassion, still this act is pretty drastic. I might be in some great pain called hell afterwards, even though I really think this would be good. But it's better that I go to hell than this other person. Because if they kill like thousands of people with anger and no compassion, they're really going to be in hell for a long time. So to prevent, this is kind of funny reasoning. It's to save the other beings, but it's also to help the killer. And this, you know, has to do with the view of the six realms and rebirth and so on. But it's to prevent their suffering from doing this horrible act.
Yeah, it's funny. Even before you read that, I read something quite similar to this in a Pema Chodron pamphlet or manual, and she related to killing. She related to this person killing a pirate.
Yeah.
That was about to kill a bunch of people.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I think that's the classic story. The sutra.
Couldn't understand why at first he killed the pirate. He says, "Well, I killed the pirate in order to save him."
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was funny. There was no mention of his recourse mm-hmm. in that particular reading.
Hmm.
And it hadn't crossed my mind that he himself would be going to hell.
Yeah.
In the realms of hell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's kind of funny. You might think, well, even because there's much merit and it's coming from compassion, then why would he go to hell? But it just occurs to me. And hell, you know, we can take literally or we can take as the being in great, great pain for a long time in our human life.
Jail, being arrested,
yeah,
and not having the laws understand why he did what he did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, the hell of prison.
Like the treasure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Stole the money in order to pay.
Yep.
To buy the grains and stuff. And,
yep.
And they were going to cut off his head. And he was okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because he knew that he stole the money for a good reason.
Yeah. So, quite interesting that, there may be, the Bodhisattva is willing to undergo some major repercussions in order to help beings. So, it's tricky, right? This is the realm where one would have to be very, very clear about skillful means. So sometimes skillful means, traditionally, in some cases where they talk about the paramita of skillful means, only comes after great realization of emptiness and compassion, and one's like far along the Bodhisattva path, and then they, from that place of great wisdom, and then they start acting in particular skillful ways based on their deep understanding and clarity. So that one way to look at it.
I decided to.
Yeah. Skillful means. Which one sometimes we say, we use sometimes kind of lightly, right? It's like, well, skillful, even without being greatly realized bodhisattvas, we still try to practice skillful activity, right? And, we might say if we're getting into this kind of territory, making these kind of decisions, then we have to be really, really clear. May we not have to face such things. But, I think we could say with people like, terrorists or Hitler or something, you can say, how hard it would be to actually kill someone, in any situation. But it might be like, as a bodhisattva, we're like, I really don't want to do this, it's going to be really hard, but like, I think it would be good. And I think a lot of people would agree that would be.
Well, like the people on that plane on 9/11 who took down the terrorists because they ascertained that the plane was headed for, I forget where, some big, huge, hugely populated place.
Mm. Uh-huh.
And they knew, that's
a modern day example. Yep, there you go. Mm-hmm. Protect others.
Yeah.
And I think the uniquely Buddhist twist on this is it's protecting the one who's doing the crime.
Yeah. Well, they already felt like they were going to heaven, I think.
In their belief system, but we might say,
really
from the Bodhisattva's perspective, oh, that's a major delusion. It's not going to work. Even though you think you're going there, I don't think you're going to.
It's an extreme example, but it happened in our not too distant.
Having to deal with that. Yeah. So we can save the next breaking of all these natural precepts for the last week, next week. Because it goes to them all.
Because, you get on the slippery slope.
Yeah.
Of thinking that you're an exception.
Yep.
For some righteous reason.
Mm-hmm.
And
that
a lot of harm gets done because of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Even if it might be not even selfish, but just like the terrorists themselves, there's a good example, right? They didn't want to die, I don't think, actually. They're like, this is for the greater good, to kill all these people. I mean, that was...
We talk
ourselves into things for the good, so that's why we have to keep studying the Bodhisattva precepts with all of this wider context and the basic underlying understanding that they're all coming out of the our interconnectedness and selflessness and love for all beings. One more week, next week. We dedicate the merit arising from this gathering to the happiness of all beings. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.